I hate when my equipment malfunctions.
You're a pro. You need to have a backup.
Apparently. I will remedy that.
This is the Space Dojo Show, a weekly podcast about all things JavaScript. You can find out more information at show.spacedojo.com. Enjoy the show. DigitalOcean is the best place to get your Meteor application off the ground quickly and the easiest to scale when you find success. I host Crater.io there, so I understand DigitalOcean. Start with a pre-configured one-click launch, such as Node.js, to get it up and running in 55 seconds, or build the exact infrastructure you need with root access to servers running 100% SSD in state-of-the-art data centers around the world. DigitalOcean is the fastest growing cloud infrastructure provider because it's built for developers and laser focused on its mission to create simple and elegant solutions for developers and teams. Use the promo code CRATER10 on the billing page when you sign up for $10 to get started.
Welcome to the Space Dojo Show. I'm your host, Josh Owens, along with my co-hosts.
Who can go first? Ben Strahan, number one.
And I'm numero dos, Ramsey Lanier.
Yes. Welcome, guys. And we have our special guest with us this week, Richard Feldman. Welcome, Richard.
Hey, great to be here.
Yeah.
Welcome, Richard.
Hey.
You work for No Red Ink, which is a company that specializes in something. What is that?
We make grammar and writing software for English teachers, so middle school and high school primarily.
Nice. You also do, you primarily use Elm, right?
Yeah, for the front end. So it was just normal Ruby on Rails on the back end. We got into Elm about, I guess 8 months ago-ish, 8 or 9 months. And so now all of our new front end stuff is in Elm. And to be honest, we pretty much update our old React code and rewrite it in Elm at every opportunity. But it's still like a minority of our code base because like React and CoffeeScript and stuff had like a 3-year head start. But it's been going really, really well.
Nice. So I'm actually not super familiar with Elm. So could you maybe give us like a little history on what it is and why it exists, I guess?
Yeah, sure. So basically, Elm is a functional programming language that compiles the JavaScript. And the main motivation was the creator, Evan Shaplicki. He actually just gave a keynote where he laid out a little bit of this at the Erlang Factory yesterday in San Francisco. And he basically had some sort of pain points getting into JavaScript, and he was thinking about, you know, I had some of this work that I did on his thesis at Harvard about some like functional reactive programming stuff. And he was like, I bet I could make this a nicer experience. So he kind of sat down and designed some stuff. And after quite a few years of evolution, ended up with Elm. I came into it much later in the game, but it's basically the problem that it solves is maintainability. It makes it way easier to maintain your applications. And the best statistic I can give for that is that we've been using it in production for like 8 or 9 months, and we've had no runtime exceptions from our Elm code, like not even one. The compiler just catches them all. And that's not because we have a weird use case. That's just normal. It's theoretically possible to get them. Like there are ways you can do it. You can, you know, write something that infinitely recurses until it blows the stack, you know, stuff. There are definitely ways it can be done, but it's just normal for Elm programs just to not crash because the compiler catches all the bugs ahead of time. That's been the experience we've had. Stuff's way easier to refactor. And it's just a very simple, elegant language. And I have a big fan.
So is Elm essentially like, if I can correlate it with something, And I know I'm going to get this wrong, so tell me where I'm wrong. But is it like React and Flux and NPM and, I don't know, like Webpack all into one?
And not Webpack. I would say Flow instead of Webpack.
Okay, because it has its own compiler and like building and builder and all that stuff. So
yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so it's all that stuff in one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's super ambitious.
Very ambitious.
Okay. Wow. And is there like any official support by like some big players?
So So previously, Prezi was the biggest company. I guess Prezi is still sort of the biggest company. So they hired Evan to work on it because they have this big legacy Flash code base. And they were like, okay, so we know we're not going to be on Flash forever because that much is clear. But they're like, what do we want to go to? And they're like, okay, well, obviously, like HTML5 stuff is the future. But they were like, well, we talked to a lot of other companies, and they all hit these maintainability problems when they get like these really big JavaScript code bases. And actually, so Prezi started this conference called MLOC, or short for Millions of Lines of Code. And that was the MLOC.js. That was the name of the conference because that was kind of what they were concerned with, was like, how do you, you know, when you have such a big project, how do you make it all manageable? And Elm was the solution they ended up coming up with. They said, this seems like the right solution. And so they actually just hired Evan to just keep working on Elm. And that's where he worked for like a year or so. And then we hired him because we're a smaller company than Prezi. Like we only have, you know, like a dozen or so engineers, whereas they have hundreds. Because we're a smaller company, we can move faster. We've made Elm like our primary thrust, whereas Prezi's just using it like in a very minor capacity relative to their whole code base. For us, it's like a very, very big part of our code base. Part of the reason we hired Evan was, and again, he just works on Elm. He doesn't work on our product at all. But part of the reason was just for recruiting purposes. We wanted to be like, hey, you know, this is the type of place you can come work. And, you know, like, we're hiring. We've been hiring for a while. And just being able to say, you get to come work with the creator of this amazing language, you'd be surprised how many people apply saying like, hey, I heard Evan's working there and I want to work with people like that. It's pretty cool.
That's awesome. And how long ago did you guys hire Evan?
Like a month or two.
Oh, wow. Okay. So this is pretty recent.
Yeah, relatively recent. So we'd had it in production for like 7-ish months before we hired him.
Mm-hmm. Pretty cool. And so like, is your hopes coming true? Like, it's kind of like early to say, but I imagine.
Which hopes? Like,
we have a lot of hopes. You said you wanted developers to like come on and like pursue working with you guys just because Evan was part of the team and everything.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Actually, our most recent hire, it's Aaron Vonderhaar. He's the creator of Elm Format, which is, have you heard of Go Format or Go Fumped as some people call it? So I'm seeing a mix of yeses and nos. So essentially Go Format's purpose is, for people who write Go code, there's, you know, you always have these debates on teams like, okay, should we use 2-space indentation or 4-space or tabs? Should we, you know, where should new lines go? And so they eventually decided, let's just settle this and let's just make a tool that just formats your code according to a common convention. The idea is like, yes, individual people will have different preferences, but that will be like overridden by how nice the tool is, because every time you save, it'll just format your code and everybody will follow the same thing. And so we were like, that seems like a great idea. We should have that too. So Aaron wrote that. And so now we have it. It's great. So every time I save, it just makes my code look beautiful. And so everybody uses it. Actually, we just had a meeting earlier today about how we're going to go through and take all of our old Elm files that haven't been run through Elm format and just get them all up to speed so that everything across our code base uses it. And then we don't have to ever have to have a debate about that stuff ever again.
that's pretty funny, because I've been on teams where people are like, they actually force you to switch editors, and they're like, we're all going to this editor and we're going to follow these standards and everyone's going to get in line. We're all going to be a happy team because we're not having any editor wars or like, you know, tab spacing or any of that crap.
So the editor thing's a little bit weird to me, because it seems like, well, if you're using different editors, like, you know, if you're using, you know, Sublime and I'm using Atom, like what does that hurt me that you're using a different one? I guess the only way I can think is like for pair programming, because sometimes... Yeah.
They were pairing a lot,
Yeah, okay, because then you have, like, somebody uses, like, Vim bindings, then you keep having to press crazy buttons. I say being a guy who uses Sublime with Vim bindings, so guilty.
Well, I mean, you know, pairing, that's how I learned Vim, so, I mean...
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I was on TextMate and then paired with someone, and he was using Vim, and I'm like, I'll learn Vim, and now I use Vim and TMUX all the time, so...
Nice, I remember TextMate. Yeah, I keep going back and forth between Vim and Sublime, and like Sublime with Vim integration. And it's like, I like Sublime's like UI touches better, but Vim has better Vim integration, obviously. I actually just like switched back again recently from NeoVim, but go back and forth.
I still use Dreamweaver.
Oh, man.
Nice.
No. Wouldn't that be horrible? Oh, my gosh. I'm gonna put,
you know,
I'll put it out my LinkedIn and see if I get some recruiters.
Yeah,
I don't think you want those jobs.
I have to give you some like grudging respect if you did that. I knew somebody who he used Nano, and he actually had it like tricked out with syntax highlighting and everything. He just that was how he did all his editing. Yeah,
I'm a Pico master.
Exactly.
Crazy.
All right, so getting back to Elm. So you mentioned previously that I guess most of your code base is React. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
So can you walk us through like the process of how you started piecing out React components with Elm?
I can give you a high level overview, but we actually wrote a blog post about not only how do we did it, but it walks you through doing it on the to-do MVC Flux repo. So it was just like you check it out, and then it just walks you through like ripping out a Flux store and replacing it with Elm. Yeah. So the short version.
What's your blog URL?
Oh, tech like tech.noredink.com.
Cool.
And that particular blog post is called "Walkthrough Introducing Elm to a JS Web App." So one of the interesting things about Elm is that, and I've never actually seen another language that does this. So like I said, one of Elm's main selling points is maintainability. And one of the ways that it is able to offer that is because it has a much smaller set of things to work with than JavaScript. So JavaScript, there's like 10 different ways to do everything. And Elm, there's not. There's a much smaller number of ways you can do things. And because of that, the compiler is able to make certain guarantees because it can be like, oh, you're doing this thing that doesn't match up, etc. And as a result of that, when you're interoperating with JavaScript code, JavaScript does have such a bigger array of different ways to do things. And so the compiler can't, make those same guarantees about JavaScript code that it can about Elm code. When you're interoperating with JavaScript, it's not actually code sharing. It's actually just communication. So it's basically like you use the same kind of techniques to talk to JavaScript as you do to talk to a server. Like it's just like sending data back and forth. And the difference is that instead of going over the network, it's just more of a conceptual thing. You're just like, talking to it, quote unquote, in this way. And so because of that, what you end up doing when you're like trying to take out part of a piece of JavaScript code and replace it with Elm code is the first thing you think about is like, where is my API boundary? And so it's sort of like a pub sub system where Elm's like, hey, JavaScript, I'm going to broadcast these events to you, and I'm going to listen for when you want to send events back to me. And so a Flux store was actually a really convenient place to introduce Elm because Flux stores already work that way. They're just like broadcasting changes whenever stuff changes, and then they're just like listening for changes from the view. And so we just basically took one of our Flux stores and we just gutted all the methods and then had each of them, instead of like having business logic, they would just send an event over to Elm or they would listen for a response from Elm and then just pass that along to React. So we actually only ended up changing one of our source files, which was just to take out all the implementations and then replace them with calls out to our Elm code. So that was how we did it.
How is it set up? I guess it's watching files. Whenever you save a file, it recompiles. Is that how it works?
Yeah, there's different. You can use all your sort of normal tricks. If you're using it with Webpack, then obviously you just got your Webpack watcher. There's a standalone thing called Elm Live. It's on NPM. So you can just do npm install -g elm -live. And basically it just watches your code. Whenever something changes, it automatically recompiles it. And if you've got a browser window open, then it reloads it in the browser for you. So you don't have to go over and hit refresh.
Very cool. Very cool. And I guess it works with like, I don't know if this question is even going to make sense, but like it does like hot module replacement with Webpack and like that's all that stuff still.
That's a good question. I actually don't know. So I actually wrote the original Elm Webpack loader, but it was like very simple. And a number of people have, like, I just added a bunch of maintainers and they've been like adding more features. I don't know if that one works. Like I said, at NoReddit, or I think I said, maybe I didn't. So at NoReddit, we use Ruby on Rails for the backend. And so we don't actually have Webpack yet. We've been working on migrating to it. But so a lot of the stuff that we have as far as like compilation and building and stuff like that has to do with the Rails ecosystem and not the more standard Webpack Browserify type JS stack.
So like if we're comparing Elm to a lot of other languages. And the big thing that you say Elm is great at is like compiling and reducing errors and mm-hmm. everything. I imagine like that's like the main elevator pitch when you're comparing it to like Angular and React.
Definitely. Right?
Is that like the one big thing, or is there some other like things in the Elm lang that like kind of stand out as superior as well?
I mean, there's a lot of little things. I mean, overall, the experience is really nice just because it's been sort of designed from like a clean room perspective. Like Evan basically didn't sit down and say like, how can I make JavaScript better? He was like, how can I make front end development like a nice experience? Mm-hmm. So part of that is those, you know, that designed around like maintainability, but another part of it is just like these really nice little details. So one example of this is the compiler errors are just really, really nice. Let's say you're passing something, a record, which is basically like an object, and you, instead of writing out phone number, like it's this user object and it's got like a dozen fields on it. And instead of writing phone number, you have a typo and you say like phone number. So the compiler error you'll get, like in JavaScript, you would eventually get like undefined is not a function or something right. like that, because you try to access it and it wouldn't be there. But in Elm, not only will you get it a compiler time error, but it'll actually tell you like, hey, you were supposed to say phone number, but instead we had phone number. And it'll actually show you a hint. Like it'll literally say, it looks like you have a typo, and then it'll say like phone number, phone number. So it tries to like help you out as much as possible and give you like the shortest path to fixing the error possible.
So that's good at compiling. But like, what about like after compiling and you're debugging in the browser and all stuff, do you guys have any like debugging tools or anything like that? Kind of like how React has some really nice tooling with Chrome.
So there aren't like Chrome extensions per se. So there's Elm Reactor, which is the like time traveling debugger. And that's kind of like the original demo of that. But honestly, I never think we don't really use that in practice. Just because like typically if you have something that you're running like and you're surprised about what's going on at runtime. So it's not usually a crash. It's usually just like, oh, my state got into a weird place. But from that perspective, at that point, because of the way Elm's designed, you have, in the same way that Redux is, you have sort of a single state atom. And so you can pretty much just like spit that out of the console and be like, okay, what was it? And that's been enough for us. We haven't like wanted to go for anything fancier than that. I'm kind of like excited by the prospect of some of I know some of the people working on that project, the time traveling debugger in Elm. There's a lot of really exciting stuff like on the horizon that just goes way beyond debugging, but it's not out yet. So pretty much I think we're probably just going to keep sticking with like console logging stuff until that comes out. Mm-hmm. So far that's been fine. We don't like to overcomplicate things if we don't have to.
Yeah. And along with like overcomplicating things. So you're saying that one of the benefits to Elm is that you have like fewer options on how to accomplish something compared mm-hmm. to JavaScript. And like, you seem really satisfied with working with Elm. And so
sure.
I think I can guess the answer to this question, but the question is like, have you come across situations where it's really frustrating that like Elm doesn't support something that you want to try to accomplish mm-hmm. or it's like a huge workaround to accomplish it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's definitely like, you know, for one thing, the Elm ecosystem is way smaller than the JavaScript ecosystem. Like JavaScript is so huge, it's been around for so long that, you know, if you've got a particular problem, you could probably just like Google it and find somebody wrote, you know, a module yeah. somewhere to do that. And it's just not the case with Elm. Elm just hasn't been around long enough yet.
Right. And I think people get into that argument like too soon, where you're almost going to be like suppressing innovation if you're like, you're trying to compare apples to apples right away when something new comes out. So now,
yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, there's also just kind of a, you know, it's a series of trade-offs, right? So it's like the problems I used to have, the specific thing that made us say, or I guess made me say like, we should really give Elm a real try was this project I worked on that was like 3 months long and it involved several redesigns because we kept going out and trying it in the field and it just wasn't effective. Like we would show it to students and they just like weren't learning it. We're like, okay, this design must be bad. Let's go back and redesign it. And every time we did that, getting it back to an MVP version where we could show it to students again, in theory, that should have been like some refactoring and just like some, you know, making some changes. But in practice, it was just so error prone, like stuff just kept breaking. And I was like, man, I've been doing Elm on the side, and I know this like doesn't happen. This is like a very different experience where you make a big change and you have to move stuff around and like plug wires into other things. Mm-hmm. And then the compiler just tells you all the places you fixed. And like pretty much always, once it compiles, it just works. And that was like the exact opposite experience I was getting here. And I was like, okay, after based on that experience, like I did the whole thing in React. And by the end of it, I was like, all right, you know, fool me twice, shame on me. I know better than this. Let's try out Elm and see what it does for us. And since then, we've had like really big, ambitious projects that have, you know, just a ton of code, ton is going on, and we were able to just make changes to them, and it's fine. Like, it's not arduous. It's like, you know, we've always had parts of our code base in the past where we're like, oh, that we're going to make a change to that feature. Like, that's scary. Like, I don't know what that's going to do. I don't know what kind of estimate I can give you on that, because that's just going to be a giant nightmare, you know, trying to change that without introducing regressions. And it's like, you know, we have tests on this stuff, but like the problem with making serious changes to old code is that you break all your tests, you know. If you're making a small change and it's like you just want to make sure that you didn't, you know, mess up the logic somehow, then tests are, you know, totally have you covered. But when you're making like serious design changes and you have to throw out tests, then suddenly all bets are off. But the Elm compiler, fortunately, is just like picks up the slack there, because it's not based on your having to write stuff. It just does its job no matter what changes you made. So now when we have our big pieces of, you know, like our big features that are done in Elm and we need to make changes to them, we're just like, yeah, that's not intimidating at all. That'll be fine. You know, here's the estimate.
That's kind of interesting. You brought up tests. Like what does that look like, you know, in Elm? Like what were you guys using before? Are you sticking with that now? I mean, obviously like there's probably some kind of integration with Rails that you're doing, or Cucumber or something, right?
Yep. Yeah. Great question. So our tests break down into three categories. So we have unit tests, and then we have integration tests on Karma, and then we have integration tests on Capybara. So the difference between the three is basically unit tests are by far the fastest to run. Previously, we were using Jasmine and Mocha for that, and now for our Elm tests, there's a unit test runner called Elm Test. You may notice a convention here, which is that, and it's very intentional, is that Elm likes to have its tools named after what they do. So you have like Elm Test, which is for tests, and you have Elm Package, which is for your package manager, and Elm REPL, and stuff like that. And then so you have like Jasmine for and Mocha for JavaScript unit tests. And then, so our integration tests, Karma is like, you know, just brings up a headless PhantomJS instance and runs your tests with actual simulated clicks and stuff, but doesn't actually touch the database. And then Capybara actually is like completely end-to-end setting up the database, like actually mocking out, you know, saving things and recording things and so forth. Our integration tests and like end-to-end tests have been totally the same. We haven't changed our Karma or Capybara stuff. It's just the unit tests, which obviously, you know, we use Elm test instead of Jasmine or Mocha.
Maybe we can, let's take a step back a little bit, and maybe people who aren't that familiar with functional programming, can you talk a little bit about what makes Elm so maintainable, like why functional programming is a good thing, and then maybe talk about like composition and all the good stuff that comes with functional programming.
Sure. Yeah. So I should mention that I'm not like a big like functional programming zealot by any stretch. I'm a very practical guy. Like I just like building stuff. And what drew me to Elm was not like you know, I want to like apply my knowledge of category theory, which is zero, you know, somewhere. It's very much the opposite. It's more like I have these problems that I keep seeing, and you know, as I've been building more and more software over the years, and I'm like, you know, this seems like it might be a solution to them. Let's find out. And it turned out the answer was yes. So basically, okay, concrete example of this is like, you have you're running your application, and all of a sudden, you notice that like your local storage. And I'm just going to use local storage because it's kind of the simplest example, but you're like, local storage ended up with a crazy value in it. And you're like, okay, who did that? Like one of my functions, like wrote something to local storage that I wasn't expecting. And now local storage is in a bad state. So the question is like, who did that? And in JavaScript, the answer is like literally any function, right? You can just write like local storage dot whatever equals whatever else. And that's just going to happen, right? When that line of code gets run. And so you just basically have to like search over your whole code base to try and figure out where it happened. Or like when you're debugging, you have to step through line by line until and just watch it and see when it changes. So in contrast, Elm, basically the way Elm does effects and things like that is it's always with a return value. So like in JavaScript, sometimes you return a promise and you're like, okay, so I'm going to return this promise and then I'll chain them together with then and it'll be great. But as we all know, that's not sort of something that helps you with debugging because promises is just an option. It's not the only way. It's like one of many possible ways. So you could have synchronous writes via local storage. You could have async via callback, or you could have async via promise. You can mix and match however you want. It's just up to the API author. Whereas in Elm, you only have one way of doing those, and it's always through a return value. It's called a task. And so a task basically works like a promise, except that, like similar to a callback, when you instantiate a task, it doesn't do anything right away. So it's like a promise in that you can chain them together, and it's got this built-in idea of error handling with like you have either the success or the error case. But that's the only way to do it. It's like the only game in town, and the entire Elm language is a task or something like this. So all of the APIs are written in terms of this, which means that if you're looking at a given function, you're like, okay, did this function touch local storage? All you have to figure out is like, what does this function return? So if this function is like returning a user object, you're like, nope, could not have possibly touched local storage because it has to return a task if it's going to touch, you know, any of this stuff, if it's going to touch local storage at all. Look at another function, you're like, oh, what is this function doing? And you're like, this function returns a task, but I noticed that the error type of that task is like an HTTP error, which tells you, oh, this function is only talking to the network. It's only doing AJAX stuff. It's not touching local storage either. And furthermore, you know that each of those functions, all of the functions that they're calling couldn't be to blame either because all they can do is return stuff. So based on this, you can just immediately rule out like entire enormous chunks of your code base as the potential culprit for this bug because just by looking at what they return. And the only reason that you're able to do that is that Elm has this guarantee across everything that like this is the only way to do it. You can only do it this one nice way. And nobody else is allowed to break the rules and do anything else because the compiler will guarantee that nobody else is breaking the rules.
That was a very thorough, great example. Thank you.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, it was impressive.
So I'm a front end developer by trade, and so I do a lot of front end animation and stuff. So I use like a lot of, you know, third party animation libraries, mm-hmm. whatever. How easy is it to integrate that type of stuff into Elm?
Yeah, like jQuery plugins, you know, like D3, like stuff that like people really rely on.
Yeah. Okay. So I could speak to a couple things. I can't, unfortunately, like give you like firsthand experience on animation because I basically don't do much of it. I know that Elm has like somebody has written some like Elm animation libraries with like interpolation and stuff like that, but I haven't personally used them, so I can't really say what the experience is like there. As far as third-party stuff, so we actually use a jQuery date picker on one of our most complicated like Elm UIs. And again, it's using that same method that I mentioned earlier of like sort of the client, quote unquote, client server communication model. So basically like user clicks in the box, we send out a request to sort of JavaScript land and say, hey, bring up that jQuery date picker that shows up. User clicks on a date, you know, we have an event handler on that. And then we say, oh, we got the result. Now we know what date it is. Send that back to Elm. You know, that's it. It's basically like, that page is like 99% Elm and then just like one, you know, like a couple of lines of JavaScript to talk to our jQuery plugin. And what's funny about that is that like, we're like, we hate that thing so much because all the bugs on that page of that jQuery date picker, like the Elm stuff is always totally fine. But then like whenever we have something, you know, like blow up on that page, it's always because of that date picker. And we're always like, we should just rewrite it in Elm. They're like, no, we can't rewrite a date picker in Elm. Come on, that's ridiculous. Nobody does that. But we're always like just like on the cusp of doing it every time we have a problem with it. But we still have it. We're still using it in production like that. Same.
That's the same story with like React. Like the jQuery date picker. Well, I was at like Sprout Social here in Chicago, and we had a whole meetup conversation just about the date picker and how they didn't want to rewrite it. And they just like, how the heck React to work with jQuery events and all that stuff.
Yeah. And so, but that does bring a good point is like, you know, has how easy is that? And the answer is that like, it's definitely more work to do that from Elm than it would be from JavaScript. Like in JavaScript, you can just like drop that sucker in and just like call the function, you're done. In Elm, it's actually like, you actually have to like, you know, set up communication between these two. It's not trivial. So if you're building the type of application where you're like, mainly what we're going to do is we're just going to grab like a dozen off the shelf components and wire them together. Like, I'll be totally honest, like Elm is probably not the right tool for that. You know, it's just going to be like more work and you're not going to get the benefit. Like Elm is really like, to get the benefits out of Elm, it's really like for the type of application where you have like a big code base that's written in house, like you're maintaining it over a long period of time. Like that's really where it's good.
Mm-hmm. Now you guys have your own like package manager, right?
Elm does. Yeah.
Okay. Like, would that be something where like the extra code that you need to wrap the jQuery plugin with, is that something that could like end up on this package manager that you guys have?
Yes and no. So like you can't package up. So before the show started, we were talking about Atmosphere and how a thing that started happening on Atmosphere is that people would just take an NPM module and just wrap it up in Atmosphere and then publish it on Atmosphere. Sure. And I don't even have to like explain what the problems of that are, because you can imagine like things get out of sync. There's drift. It's like all this bad scene. So actually, the Elm package manager has a rule, which is that you're not allowed to publish like JavaScript up there. You're only allowed to publish Elm code on the Elm package manager. So if you want to, you can publish something that says like, hey, here is an API for talking to this particular JavaScript library, but you got to hook it up yourself. So you as an end user are responsible for hooking that up and dealing with whatever the package is, but there's not going to be code duplication.
Oh my gosh. That's a potential to get some like massive Stack Overflow points then.
Yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, so I'll tell you why that design decision was made. So one thing that's true about the Elm package manager is that semantic versioning is automatically enforced across every packager. So what that means is if I make a breaking change to my API, like I say, like I delete something or I change the way like some of the arguments that something takes, and I try to publish that without bumping the major version number, it will automatically detect that and reject it and say, no, you have to bump the major version number because you made a breaking change.
Hallelujah.
Yeah. That is a- I don't know of any other process that has that.
I don't think there is. Like honestly, that's probably the hardest thing. Like so many people get that wrong. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I remember when like there was a version of underscore that came out, and it was quote unquote a minor version bump, but it actually broke stuff, and like a lot of people were you know, understandably kind of surprised about that. To put it gently, but yeah, in Elm, it's like, you know, if you make a breaking API change, like, you have to bump the major version number. And like if you're adding stuff, you have to bump the minor version number. You can't call that a patch release if it's adding new functionality. And again, that's not only is that automatically detected, but you can actually, there's a command you can run called elm package diff, and you give it a package in two versions, and it'll just generate a diff with actual like pluses and minuses and show you exactly what changed in the API between those two. Mm. So obviously it can't like, you know, translate the implementation into English or anything and be like, oh, this function used to, you know, use this algorithm, but now it uses that algorithm. But as far as the actual API, like it's very aware of that, and it's like very powerful with what it can do.
So that if you can't use like NPM packages or like jQuery plugins in Elm packages, then that kind of like makes a lot of sense when like your team says, man, let's just like rewrite this thing in Elm. Mm-hmm. You know? Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, now,
the goal is basically to just like, it's like, let's make a really nice ecosystem and let's like do whatever we can to preserve that. And so in a lot of cases, it's like, well, we could do the expedient thing and make it so that like those are permitted. But now all of a sudden, you can no longer rely on this guarantee that we have across the whole packages, because we all know NPM does not enforce that. So as soon as you're like, we can just bring this in and include those in the ecosystem, no longer can you say across the whole ecosystem that, you know, semantic versioning is guaranteed. And that's valuable to be able to say.
So like not to be like 100% inclusive, but instead like be able to build a very opinionated and like functionals, I don't know, is the word that just comes to my mind, a framework to be like, it's more functional.
Well, what's interesting is that it's actually not so much like opinionated as it is like, it's really very much the case that like Elm is driven by these guarantees. And it's so like, okay, if we want to guarantee this, we want to guarantee that like, you're not going to get runtime exceptions, I guess, except in these like very unusual cases. Like we want to guarantee that semantic versioning is enforced everywhere, things like that. And then from that, it's like, okay, now with these guarantees in place, like, what solutions make sense. And so the first like red flag that you can raise is it's like, oh, we could go this way, but that would break one of our guarantees. Is that worth it? And in a lot of cases, the answer is like, well, no. I mean, we've been able to, you know, have this guarantee, and the only way we can keep it is if we don't do this thing. So let's not do this thing. So in a lot of cases, those, you know, those questions of like, should we allow this? Should we allow that? Get answered very quickly by like, oh, well, if we do that, then all of a sudden semantic versioning is out the window because NPM doesn't enforce semantic versioning. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I can definitely see how if you're coming at it, you know, not knowing about like the whole history of everything, you know, it's like, it seems like it's opinionated, but a lot of cases it's not really opinion. It's just like, well, there's only one way we can do this and preserve all the nice guarantees we want to have. So let's do that way.
Wow. So there is a way that like you can like implement Elm and like totally screw it up by like messing up the guarantees, or are you saying like people are protected by the Elm ling itself, these guarantees?
Yeah, that's the thing, right? It's okay. Like in JavaScript, you can mess all those things up. And so the question is like, do we let people intermingle JavaScript and Elm in the package manager? And then the answer is like, well, not if we want to have all the guarantees. But yeah, the Elm language does actually enforce all those guarantees.
That's interesting. So a good point to know is like when you're adopting Elm, it's not that you're going to be giving up JavaScript, because you're going to be totally interacting with it and using it in your project like almost 100% of the
time. Yeah, I mean, it's more just a question of like what fraction of your time is spent writing Elm versus JavaScript. So like our front end programmers spend like 95% of their time writing Elm and then 5% JavaScript, unless you're like specifically maintaining a legacy feature where you're like, okay, I need to make this one change, and like I'm not going to rewrite the whole thing in Elm just to make that one change because that'd be ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But like for new stuff or stuff that we've already converted over to Elm, it's like, yeah, it's like 95% Elm, and then maybe there's this one library where you're like, oh, I could save myself a few hours of implementation time if I grab this library off of NPM or whatever. Then we'll just grab it and, you know, talk to it with Elm and move on.
Very cool. So like with the state management that you guys have in Elm, I assume like you guys got something similar as to like React components, where you guys can like take things out and add it into another project pretty simply. And
there are definitely like some conceptual differences there, but like from an organizational perspective, you can definitely be like, yeah, we're just going to like, you know, take this, here's all of our logic that needs to happen related to that thing. And then like, and go from there. There are some like implementation details that, that like people have different like preconceived notions about like where things ought to go coming in. But again, like just talking about those guarantees, like when you have the guarantees that you do with Elm, it sort of leads you like naturally to this one particular architecture, which is known as the Elm architecture. It's kind of like a weird thing to take credit for, because like Evan put it, he's like, this is kind of like the only real way to do it that makes sense. So it's not like we like invented this like amazing new thing. It's more like, oh, well, if we want it to work in the system and not blow away any of our nice guarantees, then like this is how you do it. But then people come in like, why did you choose to do it that way? It's like, well, it wasn't much of a choice. but long story short, yeah. So you can definitely package up your logic and you know, like group it into components and things like that. And the Elm architecture basically describes how to do that in a way that doesn't sacrifice any of the guarantees of Elm. And it's weird because now we're seeing like in JavaScript land, you know, like Redux in particular, like explicitly cited the Elm architecture as like its inspiration. Like Dan was like, you know, hey, I came across this thing called the Elm architecture. It seemed really cool, so I ran with it and so forth. It's interesting to see because you know, of course, in JavaScript you have all these different options that make sense, and there are lots of different ways that you could do it, which is of course why there are lots of different, you know, implementations that do things in different ways. Whereas in Elm, it's pretty much like this is the one canonical one, and it's interesting to see sort of the bleed over there, where like you know, the JavaScript people are starting to take inspiration from Elm. Actually, other like. It's funny, like ever since Evan started posting like demos of like the error messages in Elm that are really nice, I've started seeing like similar things like show up in other languages where they're like, oh yeah, let's do that. It's pretty nice.
I'd have to say like that's like been the number one marketing thing for Elm, and how I heard about it initially is leaders in the JavaScript world are like, hey, it's pretty neat what Elm's doing.
Yeah.
And then people are coming over to it because of that, because the endorsement or just a little mention.
It's hard not to try it and like walk away thinking like, oh, that's just like whatever. Like you try it, if you actually build something with it, you're like, whoa, this was like very different than what I'm used to, and I kind of don't ever want to go back.
I mean, that's probably true. Like for me with React as well. Like I just, tried React. Like I started about a month and a half ago and I was like, that was weird. And now I'm like, why the hell would I do it any other way?
Yeah, so Elm uses the same like virtual DOM style rendering that React does, where you just like you just write. And more specifically, it uses the stateless component style that came out in React 0.14. It's like that's all Elm has is it's all stateless components. Like you just like view function, take in what I need to do to rent like the state that I need to do to render this, and then just return the DOM structure that I want. That's it.
That brings up something interesting too, because like I'm looking at this post. I keep hearing things about Elm Native. Is this like a thing?
Yeah. Okay. So this is basically I was at Reactive 2015 last year, and I was meeting up with like Andre Staltz and Aussie and like a couple of other people, and we kept talking about how like one of the most common things that people were asking at the conference is like, does Elm have a React Native story yet? Like, is there a way to compile Elm code to React Native? And I was like, no, like nobody's working on that. And we kept chatting about this. And I think Aussie was like, I bet I could just do that. Like, what if we just tried it out? And so he and Andre got together some weekend and they just like put together a proof of concept and it totally works. They put it up there. Like, as far as I understand it, it's like very much not ready for prime time yet. It's like, the first proof of concept they put together was just like a very like hello world plus like a button you could press to like change something on the screen, right? But like since then it's been getting more and more activity and like, yeah, so I saw last week somebody else tweeted that like they had started using it for something. I was kind of like, whoa, I didn't realize it was that far along yet. But I definitely have not used it myself, and I also know basically nothing about React Native, so I'm not going to claim to be up on that. Like you'd have to ask one of them, but it definitely seems like a cool project.
Is there any difference to like using CSS styling? Like, is it pretty much like the same as React, or are you?
It definitely can be. So the way we've been doing it for a long time, like we use Sass at Norit Inc. And so we, you know, basically just keep our style sheets separate. If you want, you can do inline styles with React. But I actually came up with a project recently, which is trying to get the best of both worlds. So it's called Elm CSS, and it's a CSS preprocessor, which means I realize I just erased all of my credibility as a sane person because I said I wrote a CSS preprocessor, but I did. And the motivation was basically, I was like, okay, so it seems like the nice things about inline styles are that, one, I guess there's a few things that people who are like advocating for that site. But some of the things are like you get to co-locate your styles with your code, and that you get to share like constants and things like that, like not only in your style sheet but also like with your view. Whereas if you even with Sass, like you don't really have your Sass variables like being shared inside your code where they can like reference each other. And so basically I was like, okay, but what if we had something like Sass, except where the language you're writing in is Elm instead of like Sass's language. And so it still just spits out .css files. But now that it's in the same language, you can actually like share code between your style sheet and your view, not for logic, but just for things like class names and things like that. So check it out. So this is what it does. So basically, you can say like, here is an enumeration of all of my classes and all of my IDs for this particular component. And then you use those same enumerated values, like rather than just raw strings, you just like share those actual constants between your view and your style sheet, which means that if you're ever like, oh, I don't think I'm using this style anymore, you can delete it. And if you are still using it somewhere, Elm's compiler will break and tell you about it. It'll be like, oh, hey, you're using this thing that's like not referenced anymore. So now you can actually like delete your styles with confidence and be like, I know that this isn't being used anymore because the compiler would have told me if it wasn't. And what's even cooler, I didn't even think of this originally when I started doing it, but another guy who, Luke Westby, who started like coming in and working on the project, pointed out that, hey, it's the same language. So if you want, you could just like literally put your style for a particular component like in the view, like right above the component, right? Just like have it in the same file, but just like run Elm's compiler on that file to generate the JavaScript, and then run Elm CSS on the same file to generate the CSS. And like each of them's just gonna like see some other stuff that it doesn't care about. Like Elm CSS doesn't care about your view code, but it doesn't matter. It's not hurting anything that it's in that file with it. It's just gonna ignore it and just, you know, spell out the CSS. and then vice versa with the JavaScript part. And so now you can organize stuff where you just have one file with like, here's my styles, here's my view function, and they're just like right side by side in the same language coexisting. We actually have a proof of concept of that. My coworker Noah wrote this thing that is basically like a generator for like Elm code that like deals with client server interactions. So we have these things called encoders and decoders, which basically take like JSON and then wrap them up in whatever representation you want to use internally. Because a lot of times it's like you don't just want to use like the same exact thing that you got from the server, like just the raw JSON. Like pretty much always you want to turn it into something a little bit nicer to work with. And so he just wrote this thing where you just, it's like those like CSS to SAS or SAS to CSS or whatever, like websites where you just like have on the left, you're like paste your JSON in here. And then on the right, it just generates like a good starting point for some like Elm code to like do the decoder and encoder and stuff. So you can just copy paste it into your code and just like get a good starting point. Basically like to reduce, you know, like mechanical work that would otherwise, you know, like you want that code to exist, but you don't want to have to write it all out by hand. So then you can just copy it in and just tweak it. Anyway, so for that project, he used Elm CSS in that style where it's like using the styles right there in line with the view functions. And it works. It's pretty cool. And then along the way, I accidentally ended up implementing post CSS in there too. So like I had like a namespace feature that I wanted to implement. And originally I just like baked it in and then I was like kind of showing it to some people for a code review. And they're like, you realize that like you've got this like representation of like what your style sheet's going to look like. But if you just like expose that, then people could write, you know, like an auto prefixer on top of that or like a namespacer on top of that. I was like, oh yeah, you're right. Oops, I guess I accidentally implemented post CSS. So basically I ended up with like a CSS preprocessor that is SAS plus post CSS, but written in Elm and like you use Elm code to write it.
Cool. So, is that like open source somewhere?
Yeah it's github.com/rtfeldman/elm-css.
Awesome. Cool. Does that actually generate, does it actually generate separate CSS files or does it put them in line or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it generates .css files. And there's a little like node-based CLI, so you can just like npm install -g elm-css, and then you can just like feed it the files that are in a particular format, and then it'll spit out CSS files. Somebody's working on a Webpack loader, but I don't think it's done yet.
Where do people go to like learn Elm?
So the website is elm-lang.org. I have not personally used it because it's been a long time since I've needed a tutorial, but I've heard really good things about elm-tutorial.org. A lot of people have said that that's like they had a lot of good success getting through that, and like it was like a really good introduction to Elm. Also on our company blog, if you want just like a practical, like I'm going to build a thing in Elm, we have another blog post that's called "Building a Live Validated Signup Form in Elm," and it just basically assumes zero Elm knowledge, zero functional programming knowledge. It's just like all you know is JavaScript. If you walk through that blog post, by the end of it, you've built a live validated signup form that like validates email address and talks to GitHub, you know, to see if username is available, stuff like that. That's it.
Nice. Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on the show, Richard.
Happy to be here.
Yeah.
This is fun.
I'm like immediately going to go check out like literally right after this.
Very cool. Well, we have one other thing I guess I should mention is just that like there's a mailing list called Elm Discuss, like Elm-Discuss. If you Google that, like super, super beginner friendly. Like you just like ask a question on there and you're just like, hey, I'm stuck on this or I don't understand this. And like within a ridiculously short period of time, someone will respond with a ridiculously nice answer. At least that's been my experience. So awesome. Definitely recommend that.
Wow. That's some good marketing there. Okay, guys, let's do this. Let's test this out.
So yeah, go for it. Let's do our picks. I don't think we did them last time. Did we do picks?
We totally forgot about them last time.
Yeah. All right. So normally what we do at the end is just pick something that has maybe affected or changed your life in some way. It could be, it doesn't even have to do with programming, right? Like just something that's pretty awesome. So
yeah. Like preferably something not to do with programming. So that, like we prove to the world that we've gotten out of our society.
And before we do our picks, I do want to say we now have a sponsor. DigitalOcean.
DigitalOcean.
Sponsoring. Huh?
I'm a customer.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a customer too. Crater's there. Yeah, so if you're interested, check them out, digitalocean.com. And you use the coupon code CRATER10, I believe it is, and you'll get a $10 credit. So check them out. So picks, who wants to go first?
I mean, this is lame, but Tom Clancy's The Division just came out. I'm a big video gamer, and it has been crushing my productivity. So I guess it's not like, I don't know. It's really good, though. I love it. Very good game.
Nice. Nice.
So also, my kids.
nice. Nice. I like that. Also, I have offspring. I'll say House of Cards. Like, if we're talking about productivity killers, like, that one killed off my...
Have you finished it?
No, we're still, like, I think we got, like, 2 episodes left.
Nice. Like, I'm halfway through.
I'm like way behind on client work, so I've been working every night. But it's like every other night I'm like there and we watch like 3 episodes. My wife's like, I can't do this anymore. I'm like dreaming about political stuff. Oh, goodness.
All right, no spoilers.
Oh, man. I was actually going to do House of Cards.
Ah, so pennies.
So I'll have to do like something else. So like,
I'll buy you some time.
Nice.
All right, so I'm going to pick the book Flex by Ferret Steinmetz. So it's I don't want to give any spoilers away, but it is video game related, or it turns out to be a little bit later on. The basic premise of it is the idea that it's like modern day times, except that the one thing that's different is if people get sufficiently obsessed with a thing, then suddenly they develop these like magical powers where they can like control that thing or do things related to that thing. So just as a hypothetical, let's say you're really, really obsessed with video games, that might give you powers such as like you can make a med pack happen, but you can't just like summon as many med packs as you want. It has to appear in the context of like a level, like real life like warps to become a level where you have to go find the med pack about where it would be in a video game level. So imagine a world where you have people like with those types of powers, and then mayhem ensues. Very, very interesting, entertaining, like lots of in jokes and like nods to anyone who's into like video gaming and nerd stuff. Very cool book.
That does sound really cool.
Yeah, there's a sequel out now too called The Flux. It's
Flux.
Mm. Yeah, nothing to do with like reactive flux.
I'm not interested then. I don't know. I'd have to say. Oh, there's this thing that my wife and I were like just cracking up like crazy. We found a YouTube channel called Bad Lip Reading.
Oh, Bad Lip Syncing?
Yes. Yeah. It's called Bad Lip Reading, but it is like voiceovers.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. And we found the one like with Ted Cruz. And it's just like, if I met the guy in person, I knew him, I would like imagine that's who he is. Like, it's just like so bad. If you guys know what I'm talking about.
Yes, totally. Like, I remember the first time I saw that, it was like a Rick Perry video. And they were lip syncing that. He's done McDonald's commercials too. He does like the NFL McDonald's commercials where he'll do the lip back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
It's good stuff. Yeah, yeah, nice. YouTube's like addicting. I could see why like they made like YouTube Red. Because things are getting like pretty good on it. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Like, so I think your kids maybe aren't quite old enough, but like my kids are either on YouTube or Minecraft, and that's it. That's all that their life involves.
Yeah, I had to cut YouTube out. Now it's PBS Kids all the way.
Yeah.
Kids were getting to like, my oldest daughter's almost 5, and one day she was just,
well, there's
something like, I just overheard her iPad and I was like, it wasn't like anything. Like,
oh, yeah.
But it was like, okay.
No, we had that problem too. But our daughter's 11, and she looked at some stuff she shouldn't have been looking at, and it turned out like I didn't even know that stuff was on YouTube. So it was like shocking to me.
But, oh no.
There's a YouTube kid.
Was she watching Donald Trump videos or what?
Huh?
Watching Donald Trump videos?
Yes. So,
yeah.
When you're older.
What's a carpet bomb, Dad?
But no, there's a good YouTube kids app you should check out, Ramsey. And they like
I have that one.
They screen the videos a little better, I guess.
Just don't let your kids watch Skylander Boy and Girl channel.
I don't know what that is.
Okay. No problem.
It's just like my kids watch it and like all of a sudden like all craziness ensues in my house and I'm just like I just know it. I just yell. I just know what it is. I'm like, turn off Skylander Boy and Girl right now. They do. Everything calms down. So anyway, just a warning to all the parents out there. I'm showing my age.
All right, guys. Well, thank you for this episode. Really appreciate it, Richard. And who knows, maybe you've got some Meteor converts that are going to be writing Elm soon.
I think so.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. That's tune in next time, guys.
All right, take it easy.
Bye.
Ciao.
This has been a Space Dojo production. You can find out more information about Space Dojo at spacedojo.com. It's easy to join the mailing list and stay in the loop. That's SpaceDojo.com.